This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Tracing the origins of the Middle East conflict is tricky business, if it's possible at all, but it is possible to locate key turning points. John Judis examines a pivotal period in his new book. It's called Genesis: Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. In it, he examines the pressures that came to bear on the Truman administration to create a Jewish state after World War II. John Judis is senior editor for The New Republic. He's going to be speaking at the Kalila Synagogue in Chapel Hill tonight at 7:30, but joins us on The State of Things now. John Judis, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, how did this whole thing start? No, I'm not going to say.
Well, the whole thing started in the 1880s or 1890s in the Pale of Settlement, which is the area right outside Russia, Eastern Europe, Poland, where the most of Europe's Jews lived. And where during that period you had simultaneously the growth of nationalism in a lot of those countries and anti-Semitism and pogroms, persecution of the Jews. And the idea of a Zionist movement, a movement itself, starts in Odessa, and where Putin is just established Russian state.
And again, under the same theories, the idea, as you say, this is the growth of nationalism. The nation state has come into its own. And what it tells minority populations is become a nation or be subject to this kind of bad treatment for the rest of your
lives. Exactly. Lives. That's what the Jews of the time in the Pale said were, we are being treated as an alien nation, as a nationality, but we don't have a nation ourselves. If we have a nation, then we will escape the scourge of anti-Semitism. That will solve all our problems. So the question just was where to create this nation.
And how to gain support. In the 1880s, it was debatable and debated among Jews around the world. It starts to gain currency, and the British move it forward in the beginning of the 20th century.
Right. And you get the idea of a Jewish state from Theodor Herzl, and the idea that it should be established in Palestine. And Jews become part of a movement for national self-determination, and that is the positive side of Zionism. The more questionable, darker side is that they wanted to establish a state in a place where Jews were about 4% or 5% of the population in the 1890s, and where the people themselves had lived for 1,400 years, if not longer. Maybe back to the Canaanites and Philistines. Maybe they have as long a legacy, I'm saying, as the Jews did in that region.
It is clear why the Jews would want to create a state in this environment. Why then do the British sign on to this in 1917?
Well, there's several reasons. The British, some of the British leaders, Lloyd George and Arthur Balfour, are Christian Zionists, brought up on the Bible, believe that it is the Jews' right to reclaim their homeland there. But they also wanted a buffer zone between Turkey, which was fighting with the Germans, and the Egypt and the Suez Canal, which they valued. And they also wanted Palestine as a ground route to their empire, to India.
And ironically, some of this is sold. As you say, they were sort of Christian Zionists who saw this as kind of part of the mission. But also, they can use anti-Semitism in Britain as a kind of a selling point if we create a state.
Yeah. That's the thing that's often ignored, is that Arthur Balfour, when he was prime minister in 1905, was one of the sponsors of legislation limiting Jewish immigration to Great Britain. And the rationale, he said, is, well, if there's too many Jews here, there'll be anti-Semitism. So in that sense, for him, the idea of sending all the Jews to Palestine was a great idea.
It was a kind of benign ethnic cleansing as far as they were concerned. All right, fast forward now. Let's get to the end of World War II. The Truman administration, a lot on the plate, including this question of whether to create a state. And there were a couple of options. You could have two states. You could have one federated state of Arabs and Jews, and then you could have a single state.
Yeah, well, Truman comes into office in April 1945, and he inherits a terrible situation because you have, on the one hand, the Arabs who feel that their country is being robbed from them by the Jews. They want self-rule, self-determination like other Arabs and the Iraqis, the Syrians, so on. On the other hand, you have the Jews who are denied immigration now into the United States and Europe, desperately are seeking to get out in the face of Nazi persecution and the Final Solution and the anti-Semitism throughout that whole region. So you have these two people that are pitted against each other, and Truman comes into the situation, and the question for him is what to do. And he himself has two impulses. First, he saw the Nazis as absolute evil, and he was enormously sympathetic to the refugees who were stuck in Europe in displaced camps, and he wanted them to be able to go to Palestine. And that annoyed the British, who controlled Palestine at the time, and feared that the Arabs would revolt. So that's one side of Truman. The other side is that he was not in favor of either a Jewish state or an Arab state. He thought that one people would trample on the rights of the others. It was a question of fairness and justice. And he also thought if you tried to impose one state or the other, you'd have the basis for wars and riots and rebellion for years to come. And the Soviet Union would get involved. I think that's what he feared in 46 and 47. He even talked about it being a scene of a World War III. So those were the two reasons that drove him to try to create some kind of a federation. And he worked out a plan with Bevin, the foreign minister in Britain,
England, yeah.
For a kind of federation where there would be separate Jewish and Arab enclaves, a joint legislature, and the UN would have a mandate of overall rule until such a time as the two parties could get together amicably. But in August of 1946, he gave that up, and he gave it up largely under political pressure. So that's the—
I'm going to talk about that pressure in a minute, but there was reason for him to be optimistic. Anybody looking at the Middle East now would say, what kind of crazy idea is it to have these two people living together under the same government? They had been living together. They'd been living together for a long time. The Jews, albeit a minority in that part of the world, Arabs and Jews had been getting along for quite some time. It's one of the myths that you take on in the book to some extent.
Absolutely.
So there is reason to hope, because that's exactly how things had been going, albeit without a government.
Well, there was reason to hope. And they had, for centuries, they had lived together, and there were a lot of Jews in Iraq, Egypt, throughout the region. But what made the difference was the idea of a Zionist movement coming there and wanting to establish a Jewish state where Arabs lived and where Arabs would have civil and religious but not political rights. And that really incredibly inflamed the situation and made it by then impossible to resolve. I mean, there were windows of opportunity where there might have been an arrangement where a federation of that kind might have worked. But it would have required, at the minimum, American troops.
By that time.
And Truman was absolutely unwilling to put American troops there, first because it was the end of World War II, and then because it was the Cold War, and he was worried about Europe. So, you know, you could think about the Balkans now. I mean, it's taken – the NATO troops are still there, keeping the peoples apart. It was by then, it was pretty much an irrepressible conflict, a term that the British themselves – used. And I don't think Truman's plan would have worked. It's just that I think that the principles that he espoused were important and should apply now just as they did then, which is fairness, an equitable arrangement that fits the moral claims of both parties. And secondly, if you don't do that, you're going to have wars and conflicts and intifadas, which is exactly what we've seen for the last 50, 60 years.
Although in many cases, in many ways, we are facing the same dynamic in that having to climb down from where we are now is the hard part, not the principle. But let me get back to another myth that you challenge in your book, which is this myth of this was a land without people and a people without land, that this occupation, that the colonization was Jewish people who were refugees who needed a place and nobody was there.
Right. That was a very common belief. If you look at the history of colonization, when the British in Dutch came to America to colonize, they also described it as desolate, a wilderness. It's very, very common. Africa also. And when in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it was very common for that area to be seen as virtually without inhabitants. And it was especially prevalent among American Zionists who were getting most of their information from people who were coming over to raise money. So you see in the Zionist press of the time, of the early, like 1910, 1912, estimates of population where there are more Jews than Arabs in the land. So there was a vast misconception. There was about 600,000-700,000 people there in the year 1900, again, about 95% Arab, Christian, or Muslim.
Yeah, but those perceptions were very important, because this brings us to the political pressure on Truman that ultimately, in a sense, led to the decision to help create the Jewish state. Talk about those pressures.
Well, in 1946, unlike 2014, the Jews made up a more significant part of the population, and they were an important voting bloc in, especially in New York, which was the California of the time. It was the crucial state. But also Maryland, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Congressional elections were coming up in 1946. The Democrats had held both houses under Roosevelt, and Truman and the Democrats feared, and reasonably so, as we could see in the present, what would happen if Republicans won the House. The Zionist movement, after the revelations about the Final Solution in Germany, becomes incredibly strong in the United States. All these people who are sitting on the fence come around, including people in Congress. You have 100,000, 200,000 active people. And you have a leader, Abba Hillel Silver, who's a brilliant tactician, and who figures out something very important, that if you want to pressure the Democrats to do something in a Democratic administration, you have to say that you're going to put them in a situation where the Republicans might win the election, even though most Jews had voted Democratic since Roosevelt's time. So that's what he did. And they mounted a tremendous amount of pressure in late July and early August, and Truman gave in. He abandoned his idea of this kind of federated Palestine. And although he continued to espouse it privately, even after he recognized Israel in May of 1948, he continued to say that was the best solution. He did not press it as a solution anymore in the public forum as the president.
How much authority did and power did the United States have at this time? Did any of the other allied powers, their ideas about this matter, France, Britain?
I would say Britain mattered, but Britain was exhausted by the war. It had tremendous debts. It was giving up its empire in India, so that didn't matter anymore. It had to pull out of Greece. I think if they could have found a way to stay there without having to have an overseas army, they might have done so. But they feared that they would face another rebellion. And indeed, they did, from the Zionists. Before it was the Arabs, then it was the Zionists, and they wanted to get out. So the United States at that point became the main outside power in the region.
John Judis is my guest today on The State of Things. He's the author of Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. He'll be at the Kehilla Synagogue in Chapel Hill tonight. You have come under a fair amount of criticism for this book, particularly within Jewish communities, for the way you framed this story.
I think that's true, and I think that that people assume from the fact that I think that the Arabs have genuine grievances, the Palestinian Arabs, that have to be addressed, that I somehow favor the elimination of the State of Israel. I don't, but I think that growing out of this history, if you look at the history from the 1890s on, you'll see that the Palestinian Arabs have reason to be angry and that their grievances have yet to be addressed. And in fact, the situation has gotten worse since 1967 and the occupation.
What is it, do you think, knowing this history, can that change any of the dynamics in this region?
Well, the thing is that the history itself has become part of the struggle. Mm-hmm. I thought that, well, I could get out of this. You know, most of the current debates, if you think about the debates about Gaza, they take this kind of he said, she said form. Who was, did Hamas really know about the kidnapping and et cetera, et cetera? And you never get any resolution. So I thought, well, if I go back 150 years, I will set the story straight and people will have an objective view. But in fact, the history itself is part of the politics. So it is hard to disentangle it. There is more, I think, more openness to this kind of view among in the American Jewish community than there has been in the last 20, 30, 40, or 50 years.
Is there, I mean, let's look at Truman's vision today for that region. Is that a viable solution? Or if we don't, if you can't maintain the status quo, is a two-state solution the only possibility, or could they live under a federation?
Oh, you mean Truman's original thing?
Well, his vision, yeah.
Some version of that might come about if the occupation continues and you have a struggle for civil rights within the West Bank. So maybe, but I think for the benefit of the Palestinian Arabs themselves, they need their own state to I think that they need to be able to exercise self-government. The ideal solution from my standpoint, and I'm not there, but just looking from afar, would be political separation, economic integration. But whether that's going to happen or not is doubtful. I don't think the Israelis are moving in such a direction that they're going to agree to a two-state solution, and that bothers me. That worries me.
Well, they will argue that their security is at stake, and if you allow that anybody with that much hostility their own state, it means the annihilation of Israel.
Well, I don't think that's true. And I think that they've had for the last 10 or 20 years a more moderate, pliable leadership in among the Palestinians than they've ever had before. They could have made a deal. They didn't. And I think that a lot of the reason has not as so much to do with security as the fact that they now have 500,000, 600,000 settlers in the West Bank who are unwilling to give up where they are.
John, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us. John Judas, the author of the new book, Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. He's going to be at the Kehillah Synagogue in Chapel Hill tonight at 7:30. Check our website for more information. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.